Have you had something that doctors just can't seem to diagnose? In fact, diagnosis was part of the adherence to diagnosis was part of the story with the CareTrack study that we just talked about. But have you had a mystery illness? Tests and scans have failed to reveal anything. Your symptoms have got worse and your case has doctors stumped. A team at the University of California, San Francisco want to put an end to traditional diagnosis where doctors make educated guesses about what you might have. Professor Joe DeRisi is co-president of the new Chan Zuckerberg Biohub, and he spoke to RN's Natasha Mitchell about how new gene sequencing technology is making medical detective work easier.
What we've been really hell-bent on doing is providing all the data, an unbiased, unprejudiced view of the patient or the patient sample driven by DNA sequencing technology that would allow us to say, what's in this patient, regardless of what we think might be in the patient? The way that we do it now is by so-called next-generation sequencing or metagenomic next-generation sequencing. And what that really means is using commercial sequencers to sort of salt the earth, sequence everything that's in a sample. So instead of sequencing a couple hundred things from a sample, as we might have done 15 years ago, these machines now enable us to sequence millions, if not billions, of pieces of DNA or RNA from a sample. And therefore, we can just sort of sequence everything that's in a patient sample, regardless of whether it's human or not. And that makes the informatics, you know, challenging, because you're looking for a needle in the haystack at the end of it. But on the other hand, it's very unbiased.
Joe, some of the patients that end up now coming to you and your team have absolutely been through the mill, haven't they? They've been through the medical mill, and in some cases, they're on death's door.
Absolutely. You know, some of the patients that we have analyzed have been on long diagnostic odysseys for which they have never received an adequate diagnosis. And if you don't have an adequate diagnosis, sometimes the treatment is not appropriate. And it's, again, not the fault of the clinician. It's just not all the data is there. One of our patients here in the San Francisco area was a construction worker. He immigrated from Nicaragua about 8 years prior to his presentation. And his main complaint upon presentation was a lot of persistent headaches and double vision, migraines. Now, the concern with double vision is that there are cranial nerves that control the eyeballs. One of the reasons they might not work right is there could be an infection in the brain. And so he had evidence there was something going on in the central nervous system that potentially could be infectious, but it wasn't clear what. Measures of what was going on in his system, like how many white blood cells there were in his cerebral spinal fluid, showed some sort of inflammatory event was occurring.
What did they think might be going on for him?
The best guess at the time was that this might be tuberculosis, meningitis. So TB, not in the lungs, but in the brain. It can happen, and it can lead to symptoms that look just like this. And that was based on a lot of brain imaging. And however, assays specifically for TB, they were never able to grow tuberculosis from his sample, nor were they able to detect nucleic acid, DNA, from the genome of tuberculosis. It looked like TB, it smelled like TB, the patient had all the characteristics, but the critical diagnostics that would have proven it was TB, they were never positive. Because of the suspicion of TB, he was put on a pretty rigorous course of anti-tuberculosis medications, which is a whole series of different drugs that also includes some steroids. And steroids, ironically, can make patients feel better. And so he had the appearance of improving, and then they would wean him off the steroids, and then he would get much worse. So he went from feeling worse to feeling better to feeling worse to feeling better. And after about a year of doing this, he had very serious indications. I mean, basically no glucose in his CSF, his cerebral spinal fluid. He had a lot of inflammatory cells there. And he had now what looked like inflammatory involvement of his brainstem. So this is becoming an ICU situation. He's not going to have any life at all. It's a life-threatening kind of condition. And the terms of our research study say that when a patient is very, very critical and all other diagnostics have failed, if there are leftover samples, like from the cerebral spinal fluid, we can analyze them via our technology to see what we can find. Ideally, we'd prefer to hear about such patients earlier in their care, but we got the call, took on the case, we processed the nucleic acids from his leftover cerebral spinal fluid sample, and then we sequenced everything in there simply to ask the question, what is not human in this sample?
I mean, that's a fantastic question because we are more bacteria than we are human, aren't we?
So if you're talking about the gut microbiome or the total number of cells in our body, that's absolutely true. However, there are locations in our body that are truly are sterile. The central nervous system and the fluid that surrounds it is pristine. A healthy CSF sample looks like Evian water.
So how much of him was human and how much wasn't?
We were taken aback by the analysis because usually with a healthy sample, you expect somebody to be 99.999% human. That's, of course, the ideal case. In this particular case, he was upwards of somewhere around 3% not human. So right off the bat, we know that there was something in there that didn't belong. We didn't know what it was. And therefore, the next part of the computational pipeline is to compare the remaining sequence to the known universe of other sequence that isn't human and compare it. And so that's, again, another hundreds of thousands of piece jigsaw puzzle against a million piece jigsaw puzzle matching game. In this case, the bioinformatics of matching his non-human sequence to the known universe of sequence was not difficult. It was a clear match, 100% identical across thousands of pieces of sequence to one organism and one organism only.
Joe, we need to tell people not to be eating right now.
The organism in this particular case turned out to be pork tapeworm.
Oh, it's gruesome.
So unfortunately, this individual had been suffering for probably some number of years with pork tapeworms that infested his central nervous system, his brain, and his spinal cord. This particular kind of pork tapeworm can create what look like on brain imaging cysts in the brain. Yeah. They're really the sort of eaten out little holes where the worm is living. So it's a very gruesome disease. It's actually responsible for probably a third of the world's epilepsy. It is not an uncommon disease. And in many parts of the developing world, the full life cycle of pork tapeworm is carried out.
And does it come from pigs?
One can get pork tapeworm in the gut by eating infected, undercooked pork. That is true. Pork tapeworm that goes to other organs of the body or the brain is acquired through a slightly different, more gruesome route. And what that is actually if individuals consume the fecal matter passed by someone who has gut tapeworm, and that fecal matter contains the larval form of the worm, that form is invasive and can move to other parts of the body, and the brain is a typical one.
Yeah, it's not pretty at all. Now, he had had hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of tests, multiple MRI scans. Why didn't they pick up on the cysts?
I think what we're now realizing is that not all tapeworm makes cysts in the classic textbook kind of way. And because of that, it was misleading. There are no cysts, therefore it's probably not tapeworm. However, the sequencing doesn't care. It doesn't care about what you think might be true or might be probable. It just sequences what happens to be there. And so it's agnostic to all that stuff.
And this is the power of the technology that you're developing.
Right. You're going in without a set preconceived notion of what you expect to find. It just simply asks, what's the data say?
How do you treat pork tapeworm? Is he okay? Is he back at work on the construction sites?
So fortunately, in his case, the drug is, there's actually a well-developed drug for pork tapeworm, is reasonably well effective, and he was treated and actually made a tremendous turnaround and is back at work and is ostensibly, from what we can tell, cured.
All that suffering. The tapeworm story, you've seen other incidences of that, haven't you? Where the treatment that people had received was actually beyond extreme.
We're working up a case actually right now where this patient had been treated for 15 years for a variety of complaints that were probably all due to pork tapeworm. She had back surgeries, she had chemotherapy, she had severe immunosuppression, and other more extreme therapies, expensive therapies too, and had been seen at some of the best institutions in the country before we managed to get a hold of her sample. And so it's, again, another diagnostic odyssey where an unbiased view of the situation may illuminate a cause that no one saw coming. I think that the way that things are going, we need to put these kinds of unbiased, unprejudiced nucleic acid-based tests up front of the process. So instead of waiting until all other diagnostics are negative, this should be one of the first that gets done. Because one, it can replace many of these send-out assays. And two, it can alert the clinician to the actual agent first and get appropriate therapy and care early. And I believe that if we roll these things out, we're eventually going to see lower cost of care and better outcomes.
How expensive is the test right now?
So right now, it's around $2,000. And that may sound like a lot of money, but consider the fact that an encephalitis patient might be in the ICU for 10 to 50 days. And every day in the ICU in a hospital like here in San Francisco is at least a minimum of $17,000 a day just for the room. If you include diagnostics and medications, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars, if not millions of dollars. And so this is a very small fraction of the total care one of those patients would normally get. And I believe that it could actually shortcut to the more appropriate therapy and get patients on a path to wellness faster, better, cheaper.
You talk about this being an unbiased way of diagnosing, but for doctors, there's a kind of deep tradition of doctoring, looking at symptoms, of touching the patient, of understanding the body and its embodiment. And does that compromise that in some way or complement it?
I think what we're doing, this data-driven approach, is highly complementary to the traditional bedside interactions that we expect of our clinicians. You're never going to replace that. That's still very, very critical to everything that's done in medicine. However, our aim is to give the treating clinician the complete picture.
Professor Joe DeRisi speaking to Natasha Mitchell. Catch Natasha's program about an extraordinary medical mystery story involving one Australian man, Robbie and the DNA Detectives, on Science Friction, which has just launched as a new weekly program on RN. Sundays at 1, Fridays at 11:30. That's in the morning. And subscribe to the podcast. I'm Norman Swan. This has been the Health Report. Join me next week.